We're talking about quantum computing for the next 50 or so minutes. I think most of you, or most people in the industry, will have heard a little bit about quantum computing. In fact, at last year's Future Decoded event, for those that are in the UK and attended, you would have seen that we ran a session at the end of the second day of Future Decoded in 2015 on quantum computing with Brian Cox, him from the telly, and Dr. Chris Sporf, who is a researcher at our Station Q, Microsoft Station Q, which is a worldwide consortium of quantum computing researchers led by Microsoft. It was a great session, and what I want to do today was really bring that whole discussion around quantum computing up to date. What's the state of the art, and what are the potential application areas? Now, quantum computing was first proposed by Richard Feynman, the physicist, back around 1982. And it's a way of looking at how do we do computation, which harnesses the way in which nature itself tries to combat and take on complex calculations. And it's based on some of the fundamentals around how the smallest building blocks of the universe really work. Now, we're beings, we've grown up, we've evolved in the classical physical world, a world of classical physics, of buildings and engineering, and of Newton's laws, and of things like gravity. But the world is very, very different when you look at the very small, the individual particles and the subatomic particles that make up the classical world. There's some strange things going on down there. The ability of a particle to also be a wave, of a particle to be in two different places at once, or to take many, the same particle to take many paths simultaneously between two points in space. All of this is really counterintuitive to the way that our brains think about the world, but it is the way in which the world works, and quantum mechanics is now a very mature and well-understood discipline. So in quantum computing, what we're trying to do is take advantage of two key quantum behaviors to try and create a computational device. And those behaviors are called superposition and entanglement. Superposition is the ability of a particle to be essentially be in two states at once. So an electron may be spinning in one direction and spinning in the other direction at exactly the same time. Again, counterintuitive, but it is the way that these things work. Entanglement, then, is the idea that the states of those particular particles, or one or more particles, can be linked. They can be entangled with each other, essentially have some kind of joint state. And it's these combination which leads us to start thinking about the idea of having qubits, quantum bits, rather than classical bits. So with a classical bit, you're all aware of that, we're all technologists. It's a bunch of electrons in a gate, which means that we can have a state of one or zero. With a qubit, a quantum bit, based on these principles of superposition in quantum mechanics, can be in both states one and zero at the same time. And if we can entangle, if we can get those bits to essentially cooperate, have a joint state, we start being able to represent very, very complex systems indeed. And here's a little example just to get your heads around this. So let's imagine a classical one-bit system that can have two states, a zero and a one. And if you're computing with that, you need two time steps to go through all of those particular states, so a zero and a one over two time steps on a classical bit. In a quantum bit, you could be in both those states at the same time. If you think about two-bit systems, clearly we need then have four time steps in a processor to explore all the possible states in that two-bit system, shown on the left there. In a two quantum bit system where the bits are entangled, all four states of that system can be essentially explored or be in those four states simultaneously at the same time. And so it goes on. You can see for a three-bit system, eight time steps in the classical sense. Obviously, an entangled set of three qubits can be in all eight states at the same time. The real power of this and the real jaw-dropping part of this is when you think then about when the numbers get very big. For 250 entangled qubits, you could potentially be looking at 10 to the 80 possible states that that system can be in simultaneously at the same time. Just to give you an idea, that's more than we think is the number of visible atoms in the universe, or atoms in the visible universe, clearly completely beyond the realms of which classical computation can really explore. So with that in mind, quantum computing has been described as the holy grail of science, with something with which we can look at large-scale complex problems that we'd never been able to do and create solutions we'd never be able to even dream of before. But what's clear, it's not an incremental technology. This isn't some sort of incremental improvement. It's a shift with the promise of disruptive impact around security and biotech and materials and medicine and sciences and artificial intelligence. But these devices, they require some exquisitely detailed engineering and control systems and nanotechnology and absolute zero chillers. It's been a technology with its own challenges, and has been one which has been 10 to 15 years away ever since it was first proposed by Richard Feynman. However, recently there's been a sharp rise in the mentions of quantum computing in the press, both in terms of the science and the mathematics and the engineering. In our Microsoft annual report in 2016, our CEO, Satya Nadella, had this to say in his covering letter to shareholders, that quantum computing is emerging today as a feasible technology. And our people and partners right now are solving the hard problems of experimental and theoretical physics, maths, and computer science that will accelerate quantum computers becoming a reality. You may also have seen in the press in the last 3 weeks that researchers, primarily led from a consortium outside out of the University of Sussex, have announced that they've built a blueprint for an actual working quantum computer. Not to say we have all the technologies yet, but there is a blueprint. So the question really is quantum computing and the benefits of it still really 10 to 15 years away? And what are we really talking about? So today, the idea is to explore quantum computing with one of the UK's leading experts and entrepreneurs in this space, Ilias Khan. Following a career in banking and his own technology company, Ilias was a founding partner of Accelerate Cambridge, the University of Cambridge's Judge Business School's highly successful accelerator. He's founder and CEO of Cambridge Quantum Computing, which is headquartered in Cambridge, but with a presence in London and the US. CQC is the world's leading independent quantum algorithm developer and also takes a very strong focus around innovation in AI and deep learning. He's a regular writer and speaker on topics related to quantum computing and computational complexity, and has long-standing interests in the philosophy of maths. He's a life member of the American Mathematical Society, a fellow of St. Edmund's College in Cambridge, and is also the chairman of the Stephen Hawking Foundation. So Ilias, welcome to Microsoft, welcome to Tech Days Online. We've got a whole sort of set of questions, I think, to explore around this area of quantum computing, but just start, how did you end up working in this field?
Well, more by accident than design, which is the way things, the best things always turn out, actually. Mm-hmm. So I was, as you've mentioned in your introduction, and I was struggling to think of who you were referring to, but anyway, so I'm old enough to have done all those things. Yeah, no, I was at the accelerator at Cambridge, and in fact, I was involved with getting the whole thing set up, and Cambridge has been a fantastic place for technology spin-outs, and we're all aware of the big success stories, and I was trying to make sure that we were perpetuating that in new technologies. So it was really that spark that got this going. And then about 3 years, 4 years ago, there was a big shift in quantum computing. And I've been following this for a very, very long time. I have been aware of the sector for some time. So it was really that shift when engineering advances started to come about that allowed us to imagine that quantum computers were finally going to be a reality.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that then. So I guess in the introduction there, I gave kind of a very fast and high-level view of some of the aspects of it. But from your perspective, how would you describe, when we talk about quantum computing and quantum technology, what are we really, what, for you, what are we really talking about?
Well, I think actually it was a very good summary, and I'd be hard put to try and advance that. But perhaps going back a step, when Feynman, Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate physicist, coined this term, there's some debate whether he did it or Deutsch did it in Oxford, Feynman actually was looking at the issue of free heat dissipation when you're looking at circuits in classical computing. And the question was, how at the lowest level of a physical manifestation of information, what is the heat loss? And he undertook a thought experiment. And so a quantum computer is a computer where information is stored or represented by the smallest element that we can manipulate. And people think of atoms, so just to give you a sense here, our minds are geared to the big. We know about the big, so we can look up at the moon and the stars, and we can think about the universe, and the mind boggles, but at least we can have a grasp of it. We have difficulty going the other way. So an atom is actually still very big for a quantum computer. We're talking now about manipulating and measuring individual photons and electrons. And just to finish on that point, the difference between the size of an electron and an atom is the same in magnitude as the difference between an apple and the Earth.
Wow.
So a quantum computer looks at storing information, manipulating that information, and computing that information, at the level either of an atom or a subatomic particle.
Got it. Okay. And so with that in mind then, so what can we do? What's the promise of being able to engineer these incredibly exquisite and complex devices to manipulate individual photons, electrons? That's great. Why are we doing all this? What's the real promise around quantum computing that meant that the level of investment and research is going into it?
Well, what has happened is that, as you, again, in your introduction, rightly pointed out, quantum mechanics, quantum physics is an area that is very well appreciated and understood. Now, the explanations of why it's the way it is are a different story that we could spend another hour on here.
Sure.
And Brian Cott's good as well, your speaker. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that at the quantum state, the laws that govern nature and reality are very different. Mm. And what has happened is that quantum information theorists have realized that at that level, we could manipulate and take advantage of those states. Mm. And suddenly, we have a significant computational speed up.
Right.
And maybe the best way of explaining it, particularly to the audience today, everybody will be aware, or at least many people will be aware, that there are certain problems that we, at the moment, cannot compute very well using classical hardware. And ultimately, all computers are physics. They're, as you mentioned, they're gates and circuits and electrical pulses. So one of these problems might be described as, let's say, MP hard, which means that it takes more than a reasonable polynomial time to compute.
Right.
Because of the laws of nature at the quantum level, suddenly the prospect of being able to solve those problems is a reality.
So there's one example, I think, which we talked a little bit about at Future Decoded, which is an interesting one. So this is a thing called the RSA 2048 challenge. So my understanding is this is a 600, we're looking at here on the screen, we're looking at a 617-digit decimal number, so a binary number at 2048 bits. And the challenge here is to factorize it, right? To break it down into all the, essentially the primes, I guess, that can be multiplied together to make this number. Now, this is quite a hard problem.
Well, right. You've just solved it, have you?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I think the biggest number ever factorized to date was the RSA 768 number, which is 232 decimals.
That's right.
And that took something like the equivalent of 3,000 years of computer time to do. So estimates for this one, I believe, are that to factorize this one on classical computers would take almost a billion years. So the challenge here is with quantum, what happens? So again, estimates produced by the folks at Station Q on a moderately sized quantum computer, I guess around 200 to 300 qubits, something like that, 100 seconds, which is an interesting comparison. It's like comparing the distance from the moon and back five times with the thickness of a sheet of paper. So this is the kind of thing we're talking about, these dramatic speed ups of certain kinds of calculation.
Yes, in short. Yeah. That, by the way, coincidentally, that 617-digit prime, that challenge, RSA laid out that challenge, I think, in 1991 or 92, and it's still outstanding.
Absolutely.
So, there's a prize out there. What I would say is that when we looked at... historically, you look back at the advent of the Turing machine and computers, let's say, in the late 40s and 50s. At that time, the advances in hardware and engineering actually were ahead of advances in theory. However, in quantum information, that's not the case. People have been looking carefully at how we use quantum computers for at least 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
And the problem you just highlighted has actually got a robust mathematical algorithm. It's Peter Shor. So Shor's algorithm factorizes very large numbers, and any reasonably competent machine, quantum machine, would find it very easy to crack any code that depended upon the RSA or elliptic curve models.
So again, I think a lot of people in the audience may have heard of Shor's algorithms. This is specific. Is it a quantum specific algorithm?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So using the formalism that is that is used to describe quantum mechanics. Mm. It's essentially a mathematical formalism, and the heart of it, the kernel of it, is linear algebra, can be manipulated. So the light bulb that went on in the late 80s, I would say, was that, oh my God, so if we had the ability to compute using nature, because this is how nature computes, we're fantastically complex organisms, then what could we do with that? And so a quantum algorithm is the methodology that is typically used to describe the more specific manipulation that ultimately measures what you originally described as superposition and entanglement. So when you look at a state, a quantum state, or a few qubits for that matter, and you want to input a large number, and you want the other end, the factors, the prime factors, well, then the algorithm is what makes that happen.
So I guess there's a number of application areas then, or problem spaces where this kind of algorithm and this kind of capability could be most directly applied. Right? And so on the screen here, there's a list here of a few of these areas. So I'm assuming that algorithm development to enable us to solve problems, design problems, numerical problems, and things like health and function. This is the area of focus, is it, for a lot of algorithmic researchers?
Yeah, just a quick terminology issue here. Yeah, and of course, in the world that we now inhabit, it is my view that over the course of the next year to 2 years, this terminology will become more and more normal because quantum technologies and quantum computing are a reality. Okay. You know, this is not science fiction. So just a couple of points. Creating a quantum algorithm is very, very, very hard. And there are very few of them. But the way in which they can be used is then manifold. And the best example of that is that in computing today, it has been proven that all problems that can be solved in polynomial time are actually the same problem.
Right.
So whether we're using a mobile phone to send a message to one another, or whether we're using a supercomputer to look at reservoir sizes in hydrocarbon extraction, actually it's the same algorithm, but programmed for different... Yeah. Now, in quantum computing, there will be a number of algorithms, and I reckon that we haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
And then there will be hundreds and thousands of people, many of whom are probably listening right now, who are very smart, who will use that tool and apply it to it. Now, the things that are currently seen as low-hanging fruit, and the thing here to remember is a quantum computer is not magic. It's not going to solve everything. It's not going to grow my hair back or anything. So, well,
I wish. If you can get an algorithm, that, please, I'll be first in the queue.
You and I both. But I think what will happen is that governments and large organizations that are involved with security are very, very concerned.
Yeah.
So cryptography, blockchain, Bitcoin, they're all vulnerable in the current system. And there are different debates and people with a vested interest in one particular, will always say, oh, no, it's 20 years away, and et cetera, et cetera. So I would say cryptography happens to be the buzzword because it happens to be the thing that people worry about most. And obviously, security implications. The one I would highlight is new materials. I think that if you can manipulate molecular structures and you can suddenly come up with new materials that affect either the dissipation of pharmaceuticals and chemicals in our bodies, make us healthier, or make materials stronger and lighter, and look at things like new energies. That is where I think there will be a dramatic impact. Now, supercomputers, I don't know what the percentage is, but some number, some really stupid number, like 70% of all supercomputers are used to look at and model new chemical compounds.
Yep.
And that is where I think... now, there are many on your screen. You've got lots of other examples, but those would be the two that I would say. Oh, I would actually, sorry, AI machine learning.
Yeah.
Very, very recently, and I mean in just in the last two or three years, and probably really only in the last year and a half, something called quantum machine learning, which means extracting patterns and information from huge data sets and actually being accurate rather than approximate, that is something that is, personally, from my standpoint, that's my area of interest.
Right.
So I would those would be the kind
Absolutely.
Of areas.
But what I take from this, though, is that there's a wide range of potential applications. I mean, it's interesting that I believe 2% of the world's energy goes on one chemical process, the Haber process, to do essentially create ammonia from nitrogen for fertilizers.
Yeah.
And if there's new molecular designs we could create for that nitrogen fixation process, you're talking a significant impact on the world's energy consumption. So there's a rich set of applications here. So I guess this is giving us a flavor of the kind of applications and the complexity we can deal with if we have a device and the software to run on that device.
Yeah, and that, we've got such a lot of depth in what you've just said. My response to that is very, very simple and quick. Mm. For too long, the mention of the word quantum computing, and your eyes glaze over, the commercial response was cryptography.
Yeah.
Today, that is not the case. You go into universities, and in Britain, we are leaders in quantum information theory. Mm-hmm. It's something that we are very good at. Mm-hmm. And the youngsters that I talk to all over the place, there are four or five hubs here, and we talk to them about what they're looking at, and it's not cryptography. It is exactly the points you've raised.
So let's move on. Let's talk a little bit then about, I'm assuming it's realistic, it's meaningful to talk separately about hardware from algorithm development for the purposes of our discussion at the moment. So let's think about the quantum hardware side. So can you give us a picture then from your perspective, like who's working on what with what kind of budget? What's the kind of players in the hardware space here? How would you think about that?
Well, one of the reasons I think we're even having this conversation is that very large, credible organizations that are commercial, that are businesses, have suddenly decided, not suddenly, but they've made public at a point in time that seems sudden, but since the middle of 2015, they've decided that the building of a quantum computer is now simply an engineering problem. It is no longer science fiction. Right. So, what I'm about to say is pretty straightforward and in the public domain, but I would say that Google and Microsoft and IBM are the leaders, and for a number of years, in the case of Google, a longer number, in the case of IBM, a slightly lesser number, budgets that are measured in billions rather than millions or hundreds of millions have been allocated.
Right.
And I think last year's annual report, 2016 for Google, suggested that it was certainly the largest single allocation in their R&D, which means that it was many billions, perhaps. I don't know what the number is. And you got Microsoft, in fact, last year came out. I don't know whether it was on purpose or it was a slip, but in one of your public talks, I think it was somebody from Redmond, not at Station Q, but somebody corporate, who highlighted that the Microsoft R&D budget, the single biggest element, is quantum computing. Now, governments are also very concerned and active. Here in the United Kingdom, the government has allocated a really decent budget. Right. And I think, actually, on the hardware side, we are, you know, in the race. Mm. We may well come up with, there's a project that we're involved with at Cambridge Quantum that could well be one of the early computers with the capacity to utilize the number of qubits that we're talking about. Mm. And then there's China, and there are at least two enormous organizations with no limits on funding, no practical limits on funding.
No limit. So there's no budget in the sense that they don't have a cap on the budget. Yeah.
Well, it's no secret. Strategically, the National Academy of Sciences in China has stated that its constraint is not budget, its constraint is people and expertise. And they can chuck whatever money they want at it, and they clearly are doing. Mm. So those are the various centres of activity. And before I forget, I just better say, coming back to the United Kingdom, I think where we lead as well is not wanting to wait until you've got the perfect machine. I said earlier, quantum information theory has advanced. It's not like the 1960s when somebody gave you a big computer and you said, well, what am I going to do with it? Is it a doorstop or something? Now, with relatively small systems, 50, 100 qubits, you can probably start doing useful stuff.
Okay, so my understanding is that there's different kinds of quantum hardware there, isn't there? So we've discussed about government players and commercial players and other research players. There are various kinds of quantum hardware or quantum research, right? So, I mean, I'm guessing we could probably spend the whole day talking about each one of these particular areas, but is there anything on the slide you can see here you'd call out then in terms of some of the key hardware approaches or research approaches going on?
Yeah, so without, you don't want me to do the detail of what it means. Okay, right, so I would say that the leader at the moment in terms of engineering adaptation is the superconducting approach and ion traps. Mm. And I would say that, for example, those of you that are listening to this and are interested can go on to the IBM quantum computing website, and they actually have public access to a 5-qubit machine. Mm. And now you're programming directly onto the metal there, effectively. I would also have to say that if you gathered, I don't know, maybe 100 people who knew what they were talking about, and they were to say which is a long-term winner, I think the topological qubit, which is being championed by you guys, amongst others, because it's room temperature, and you've got this adaptation which allows for error correction thresholds to be met very, very quickly, is a runner as well. But right now, of the machines that actually exist, I would say there are superconducting machines or ion traps.
I think the error correction thing is an important thing to bring into discussion, right? Because my understanding is that the issue is not just creating the superposition entanglement. It's about isolating that system from outside interference, essentially, so that it doesn't, you get decoherence. It basically, you lose that entanglement. And that one of the approaches, the topological approach, for example, is much, essentially, there's more inherent error correction, if you like, or robustness in terms of that coherence built into the design of the mechanism, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you want me to?
A little bit, maybe.
Yeah, okay. One of the reasons that everybody suddenly realized that this is now happening and it's no longer science fiction is that decoherence times have improved by a factor of 100, not by 100-fold, so not from 1 to 100, but to the power of 100.
Wow.
So we're still talking nanoseconds, but once you get those, that those decoherence times are being controlled and the acceleration in that because of our ability, the world's ability to use nanotechnologies and engineering, means that you now could have a collection of entangled qubits where the quote-unquote error rate is so low as to be as good as, for example, any computer that we now use. So if I haven't got my phone with me, but I've tapped my phone, every time I send a message, I'm certain, if I sent it a billion times, I'm certain that a billion times it would be correct. Well, you're approaching that.
Yeah.
Now, Google reckon that they've crossed the threshold. Mm. And last year in, I don't know when it was, sometime last year, June, I'm going to guess June, they said that in 2017 they will achieve quantum supremacy. Mm. And I've been to their AI headquarters in Venice Beach, and they've got a big banner. It's a fantastically creative environment anyway. But they've got a big banner that says quantum supremacy.
Yeah.
So Google, don't be surprised if you wake up, whilst you're on the beach in summer this year, and read a newspaper article that suddenly says that Google has achieved quantum supremacy. Right. Quantum supremacy is a technical term, and if you want me to later on, I'll explain that.
It sounds more of a technical term than a business term, but we can probably come back to that one a little bit later.
I'm not so sure, but it is a technical term,
But from it's interesting, I think you come back to the idea that obviously there's three major commercial players here.
In
the West, good point. In terms of the Microsoft approach, though, I think you know our folks at Station Q quite well. So we have our own research base. It's a consortium, worldwide consortium with the organizations you see here, including the universities of Delft and in Copenhagen, where we're primarily focused on the topological model, right? So quantum computing. So, and I think recently we announced that we had hired in some new talent, some of the two of the world's leading researchers from those organizations into the Microsoft organization to help us with our efforts. So how do you see Microsoft positioned in terms of quantum computing on the hardware side at the moment?
Well, I'm biased, right? So when in November Todd Holmdahl was announced as head, you know, that to me makes this very serious. I mean, Todd makes things, right? So you, the head of your unit, and he's on record as saying that this is now just an engineering problem. So if I were, I don't know, you know, I like football, and if I were creating a football team and I could choose whoever I wanted, well, that's what Microsoft have done. And just very recently, and I mean in the last 2 weeks, one of your top information theorists, Matthias Troyer, has co-authored a paper on using adapting neural networks with a quantum angle to look at new chemical design. It's the many-body problem. So it's I think you guys are right up there, and I happen to have a personal bias that says the topological qubit. However, in machine building, you are not yet. I think you're behind IBM. Microsoft's behind IBM, and Microsoft is behind Google. Unless, of course, in secret, somewhere at Station Q, they've got some machine which we don't know about. But I won't put it past you.
Okay. It's interesting. This is a photo we shared at Future Decoded 14 months or so ago. This is of Charlie Marx's lab at QDev in Copenhagen. So this is what a topological quantum computer looks like right now. The cylindrical bodies you can see there are the chillers. So I think we get down to a micro fraction above absolute zero in those chillers. They're actually colder than deep space. The background radiation in deep space is about 4 Kelvin. These things get down to about a hundredth of a Kelvin or something.
Yes, a part of a Kelvin, that's right. But that description that the people who are listening to this and watching this, they can see on the right hand side as you're looking at the screen, they're not really computers at this point in time. These are devices that can generate, manipulate and measure the qubit.
Right.
Although that is called the deep space, the Microsoft approach obviously is to use normal everyday substances like silicon.
Right.
So that's what's exciting about the Microsoft approach.
And of course, our ability to fabricate in silicon down to the nanotechnology level now, and the extremely small, has been one of the key enablers, I guess, of this move forward in terms of the acceleration to meaningful hardware.
For the first time today, I'm going to have to disagree with
that's
you.
That's fine.
So, yes, you know, it's possible to nano-engineer down, but even that's not small enough.
Yeah, we're talking.
Yeah. Like I said before, so an electron. So if you're doing photonics and the method of generating a qubit is a single photon. It's a sledgehammer to try and where you need a little bit of scale. I think where we've really photonics and trapped ions are two areas, and the manipulation of ions. In fact, in England, the University of Sussex recently announced a novel way for developing a large-scale quantum computer. I think it's in sort of those ancillary areas that it gets very exciting.
So we've talked a lot so far. We talked about the basics of quantum computing, a bit about the implications of it and the hardware players and some of the progress in hardware. Let's just talk a little bit about the software side or the applications, the algorithm side. So when we think about that, algorithm developments, you talked about the smaller algorithms, the application of them. When we're talking about algorithm development, what are going to be the key applications? I mean, what can we see, what we can't see going ahead in terms of how algorithms will be developed on quantum computers?
So quick health warning. Converting an algorithm into a program and the operating systems that are needed to do that is where there's a lot of excitement and a lot of work going on. And pretty much everybody who's anybody, or maybe that's the other way around, everybody who's anybody in this space is looking at how you can create this process so that you go from straight from the metal, the input-output system, all the way through to a generalized abstraction so that people can write programs. And so, do you want me to talk about the operating system development now, do you want me to wait? Should we focus on algorithms?
Let's work on algorithms for now.
So on algorithms, there's a website which is run by NIST, and it's the Quantum Algorithm Zoo. And I think, I can't remember how many there, but you know, not many, less than 1,000, more than 50, probably 100. Some are derivatives, so they're the same. And what has happened, and this is really exciting, is that we've now got smart people who are not constrained by the legacy of your last 40-odd years, and who are beginning to look at how you can apply quantum magic, shall we say, in a meaningful way. And the areas that appear to be the centers of gravity for the development of algorithm, first of all, this whole thing about how do you use quantum technologies today. So that's about cryptography, the secure delivery of a message, or a token. So how can I send you a tenner instead of using, I don't know, PayPal or something, and that somebody else doesn't steal it along the way? Because in the United States, I think it was, well, two or three white papers have come out from the NSA that says we must be quantum resistant. So there are algorithms and protocols there. There's something that we're very excited about, which is for the first time in human history, mankind can now generate and certify random numbers. This has never, we've never been able to do it.
So
all randomness.
Previously, randomness currently using computers is pseudo-random, right? So it's
an
algorithmic based. So in what way is this different?
Well, going back now to the beginning of this conversation, one of the great qualities, one of the mysteries and qualities of quantum mechanics is, of course, its randomness. And you can harness that, and a clever protocol will allow you to generate true random. And that is of great use for chemical industry, anybody who's doing Monte Carlo simulations, of course, the stock market. You know, people get very excited about, oh my God, what's going to happen in the next minute or the next seconds, things like that. Pattern recognition becomes deeper and richer over data sets. I would say those are the sort of the things where there's a lot of activity. And then off to the side, where there's not a lot of activity, but there seems to be quite a lot of progress, as you would expect, is where people who are focused on cloud delivery and cloud dependence for data sets, how do you get better at that? And that's, I mentioned earlier, quantum machine learning is coming in. So I would say those are sort of some of the areas. I think that the balance of that work is going to move away from universities into commercial organizations.
And that's an interesting question. So I'm assuming, so is the algorithm development and the software and providing solutions on quantum hardware around different business spaces, is that where essentially the money will be? Is that where the commercial applications are really going to be as we get into the quantum era?
That's a really, that's the hardest question. Ask me someone about entanglement.
Okay.
I am a businessman, obviously, because I run my own business. And we're a British business, and you know, we have a very global perspective here. I would say the following. There's a lot of very serious money coming into quantum computing. It is the hot topic in Silicon Valley right now. And I would say at the moment, from an investment capital standpoint, it's the hardware. You know, there's an excitement about building hardware. My own personal bias is that they're all just bits of machinery, and really what matters is how do you use them. And that's what I mentioned earlier. Up until now, there's been no commercial incentive to develop clever quantum algorithms. That's shifted. And that is where now I think there are some very, and that's what we're all about at Cambridge Quantum. We're a quantum algorithm company. So I think it's probably premature at the moment to be able to say much more than that. I'll give you an intuition, though. My intuition is this. Very, very large organizations have to think about being quantum ready. The budget cycle, so if you're going to build, I don't know, this building, it didn't happen overnight, right? So you had to think about it. Similarly, as companies now are beginning to think about their business cycles on a 1, 2, or 3 year basis, that quantum element is coming in. And perhaps from a revenue standpoint, from a business value standpoint, a lot of, I can see, I'll say some names, BPs of this world, British Aerospaces of this world, all these huge Chinese organizations, Toyota, and of course America, the S&P 500. There's not a large business that shouldn't start thinking about, you know, what do we do now? You know, how are we going to be affected?
So let's return to that thought just, I think, when we get to the end. I guess for a lot of our people are watching this and listening to this, making from a programming background, I'm assuming that the operating systems and programming environments for the first generation of quantum computers are going to be a little esoteric, they're going to be a little specific. So how do we think about this, the idea of how you program computers and develop them?
I don't think it's esoteric, actually. You know, I'm a great believer in demystifying things. I mean, I don't know how a car works, and I can drive it. Mm. And somebody somewhere made it that way. Mm. And I think our job is to create the tools. Right. And actually, the great thing is that everybody who I'm aware of, including Microsoft, who are in the business of building an operating system so that their machines can actually do stuff that matters, are following a tried and tested tradition. Right at the bottom, you've got the metal. Mm. Then you've got some control firmware that operates the input-output. In our case, for Quantum, you'll have some error, you probably will have some error correction. Mm. Now, above that, you then get the compiler that talks upstairs to whoever's written the program and sends it down and measures. Mm. And then you've a different aspect of the car. So I think that's what... And the magic, the thing that shifted everything, I reckon, and why we're so excited and why, in fact, probably why you've asked me to come here, is that breakthrough we've made is we've come up with this invention within the context of an operating system at one little level of it, which is the circuit control mechanism. Mm. So it's graph theory. So lots of complicated... If you have 8 or 9 nodes, qubits, you want them all talking to each other.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you know, 2 of them, or 4 of them, or 8 of them are all right. Mm. But by the time you get 10, 20, 50, oh my God, you know, so it's
one of those
and how do you, how, yeah, so that we've solved. Okay. That's what our lot have done.
Understood.
And the next bit, in fact, that part of what we've done will be used in one of the computers that's being built here. Mm. The next bit of it, which then looks up for the abstraction layer, I think initially will be some extension of C. Mm. I really don't think it's that mysterious.
So it's interesting. So just exactly. So our folks at Station Q, and Krista, in fact, leads this group, have this environment called Liquid, which is, a programming and simulation environment. Is that a way to describe this? How would we describe Liquid?
Well, Liquid is already old.
Yeah.
And I think this is one area where you guys are definitely keeping something up your sleeve. Mm. But since you asked me about Liquid, so let's call it an operating system. Let's call it a user interface.
Okay.
And at the back of it, there's a quantum simulator. Mm. So what you haven't got is the metal, for the want of a better word, but you have a very good simulator. Mm. What Liquid does, we do better.
Okay.
Right? So we've got something called Ticket. Mm-hmm. And the reason, of course, that Liquid is now outdated is that the underlying engineering is much more clear to you guys. Mm. And you're wedded to that approach because you're Microsoft and that's your machine. Mm. We are platform agnostic. Mm. And I think, therefore, to take your question broader, Liquid and IBM are probably the two best quantum interfaces. Mm. They're freely available. Anybody can go online. Mm. Anybody can play around with it. And anybody with a little bit of a maths bent who understands linear algebra will actually get a lot out of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you go onto the Station Q website, you'll see that we actually ran a competition for university students to the Quantum Challenge to develop algorithms and implementations on Liquid to solve meaningful problems. And there's a large number of entries there from around the world. So I think, so when we talk about this, we essentially, the skills required to work in this area though. So if you're developing quantum algorithms now, maybe quantum software, I mean, it's not going to be the case you just take your C# or your Java or your C++ development skills and apply them. This is a more deeply mathematical area, I guess, than standard programming.
At this stage,
yes.
I do think that in a relatively short period of time, in 2 or 3 years' time, there'll be open access libraries that will allow people with the skills that you've mentioned to come up with applications. Mm. But it's a very serious question, actually, and I think this is another reason why we're so excited. Mm. There's a confluence of an understanding about quantum mechanics, obviously a mathematical competence, and some understanding of computational complexity. Mm. It's if you imagine the intersection of those three, that is where you're getting the biggest gains right now.
Right.
And it's exciting for me because I think it's long overdue. You know, computer science has for so long been a little bit regarded. Well, actually, if you look at the millennial problems, the seven, the million-dollar prizes, well, one of them is the proving or disproving of P equals MP, which is actually a mathematical challenge as much as it is a computer challenge.
Yeah.
And in quantum computing, you've got this boundary dissolving. Mm. However, I think that that is what's going to happen in the short term. Ultimately, programmers will be able to use quantum computers and build a really interesting applications that you and I haven't even thought of.
Yeah. So, so now I'm going to put you on the spot. We talked a little bit about the basics, the potential of it, the hardware, software players, a little about where you're working. So, is quantum computing, in the sense we'd use that, not broader quantum technology like random number generators, but quantum computing, are we really talking 10 to 15 years away still? This has been the move ever since it was first announced. It's always been 10 to 15 years away. It's been kind of like a rolling horizon moving forward. What's your personal opinion on where we're at and when we might start seeing meaningful devices?
Right, so I've got a very clear view on this, and it's my view, not Microsoft's or anybody else's view. I have felt, well, 2 years ago I wrote a paper on this, and I was hopelessly out of date. You know, everything's happened a lot quicker. So every January I update it, and so I updated again last year, and just updated again. So whatever I'm about to say, I'm sure I'll be wrong, because I'll be hopelessly conservative. Now, I think that by the time we're tucking into our Christmas turkey in 2018, so what's that? Just less than 2 years away. Thousands of organizations, not hundreds of thousands, but thousands of large organizations, governments in particular, will be benefiting from computational upgrades or speed up or benefit through the use of a quantum computer and not a quantum technology. Now, whether it's disintermediated or whether it's direct depends upon, I think, initially, which methodology, because you can't have a big fridge in everybody's house. So it might be delivered in a way. So that's one thing I do think of, and I think that is clearly going to happen. It could well be that somebody like a Google develops things so that we that are using, I don't know, some search function might be the beneficiary of quantum upgrades, maybe in that year after, so maybe by 2019. Big issue there, of course, is energy, because you've got to scale these computers, and how are you going to become energy efficient? So it's a bit like in the late 40s when you had the huge, great, big ENIAC machines. You know, you had to have the power sources and et cetera, et cetera. But that, I think, will get solved a lot quicker. So, yes, that's my view. I think that, and then certainly, so my oldest boy is 11. He'll be 12 in July. So by the time he starts university in 6 years' time, we won't be talking about, oh, is this for real or not? Your machine, the one that Microsoft are building, and the one that IBM are building, you know, they've already got a 5-qubit machine. So yeah, so that's my view.
So that's interesting then. Come back to your earlier point around business investment cycles, business planning cycles. Even though those planning cycles are getting shorter and shorter in most industries, where do you think we are in terms of businesses, you know, Microsoft customers, for example, need to think about preparation, readiness, understanding, skills in this area? What's the Is that something that's more immediate from your experience?
It's becoming. I think that what happens at the moment is I'm a chief executive and I go to my CTO and I say, what about quantum computers? And then the likelihood is you'll Google it and the top 100 things will say, oh, it's 10 years away because they were written 10 years ago. And all these papers, I mean, anyway, so the mindset has been, or if you go to some of these university departments, which is computer science and not quantum information theory, again, you know, you and this is normal. You know, paradigm shifts happen when things hit you. You know, you suddenly say, oh, what was that? So the what was that moment, I think, is kind of now-ish. So at least for organizations with budgets and resources and things at stake, the question, why should I care, and what can I do to be ready? I think those questions are beginning to happen now. Fantastic. The biggest demand, I would say, on people who know about this, is I'm talking now about individuals, not organizations, is to really shrug free of that mindset. You know, just because it hasn't happened up until now doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
Very good. Ilyes, thank you for that. I really appreciate the insight there. So we're almost completely out of time, so I have to move on, I'm afraid. But just to say, we're going to be hopefully revisiting this whole particular subject area again at Future Decoded, our next event coming up October 31st, November 1st this year, back at the same place, Excel London, for those of you in the UK. So keep an eye out for what we'll be doing around Future Decoded in this area. But in the meantime, if this has stimulated your interest or your excitement, a couple of links here for you. So Elias's company, Cambridge Quantum, go the right way around, has a website with further information on, and also the Microsoft Station Q website, stationq.microsoft.com, is a source of all our public information there around both our research and general background in this particular area. With that, Elias, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time and your insight. Hope that was interesting for all of you watching. And we'll now take a short break and be back again in about 15 minutes for the next session. So with that, thank you very much.